The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Natasha Mazgavaya, chief U.S. correspondent for the leading Israeli daily newspaper, Haaretz. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. For about 2 weeks, Tucson, Arizona, where I live, has been the center of the media world, thanks to the brutal act of a deeply disturbed man who murdered 6 innocent people and wounded 13 others, including, of course, our congresswoman, friend, and frequent guest of Two Jewish, Gabrielle Giffords. While her initial survival was nothing short of miraculous, and her recovery so far has surpassed all expectations to date, there is a long road ahead for Gabby. We continue to pray for her complete recovery, as do so many all across this country and world. This has been a week of memorials and funerals, of moments of silence and prayers of healing and remembrance. Happily, some of the victims of the terrible attack actually left the hospital and have returned home. And the Martin Luther King Jr. weekend provided more opportunities for people to come together and remember and pray and sing and unite. My family and I joined in the MLK Day walk from the University of Arizona to Reed Park, which is a wonderful urban space of green and water in the middle of Tucson. We heard a variety of mostly very good tributes to both Dr. King and nonviolence, prayers for healing for our city and this country, most of which included thoughts, prayers, and hopes for the memories of the victims and the recovery of the wounded as well. It happened to be a gorgeous day here, and the remarkable diversity of the crowd and the committed, warm, loving spirit was both comforting and reassuring. There are beautiful, strange shrines to the victims of the attack in various places around Tucson right now, mostly messages to Gabby to heal, but also memorials to those who died, at the University Medical Center where she lies in intensive care, at Gifford's office, at the Safeway where the shootings occurred, at the school of the 9-year-old girl, Christina Taylor Green, who died, and elsewhere. These are touching collections of candles, pictures, flowers, handmade posters, notes, gifts, prayers, and wishes. My wife Wendy and I visited one on the grass outside the medical center, which is quite large and really impressive. We were told that there are always people walking through it, 24 hours a day, stopping to pray, meditate, and visit. It's a touching experience in many ways. You know, we Jews are not much given over to shrines by and large, and what with the various prohibitions we observe on idols and other such images of adulation, we don't do it much, but this really is moving. Most impressive was the unique spirit among the people at the shrine, a spirit that I believe has been reflected throughout my community in the past 2 weeks. People at the UMC shrine, you know, there's no other word for that place. It's a kind of civic religious experience, really. People at this UMC shrine were amazingly kind to one another. There was an aura of compassion that permeated the place. Even with dozens of media trucks and reporters from CNN, CBS, Fox News, and so on arrayed nearby, there was a kind of sad peace that made everyone there gentler. Or perhaps it was simply that everyone is being gentler these days. I've noticed that in the aftermath of this tragedy, even with heated rhetoric coming from other quarters, people here are acting with decency and kindness who had not so acted before. There's a new air in Tucson, a new approach to civic interaction that is also civil and that reflects a kind of decency that has always been present but was more likely to be latent than active. It gives me hope that out of this awful experience, good may yet be created. Without any cynicism, there's a cycle to this kind of horrifying experience. After the initial shock and anger and the immediate recovery, people are often kinder to one another. Sometimes, if people work together to continue that, it becomes a permanent part of the community's identity. Sometimes not. I remember New York City before 9/11 and the remarkable experience of visiting it again after 9/11. It was extraordinarily different, and it still is. People there will now actually ask you if you need help or directions. Toll collectors will wait patiently while you fish out your bills. Transit workers have held gates open for me and my kids when we were visiting. I've even had ticket takers advise me on how to save money on my purchase. In New York! I do not believe that in the previous 350 years of the city's existence prior to 9/11, any of this ever occurred. So there's a new hope for Tucson to become a gentler, kinder, more compassionate place. And there's also the potential that our entire country, which has been so infatuated with inflammatory, violent rhetoric filled with gun references, can relearn the central virtue of common decency and civility. We can and should disagree in a democracy, but we must do so as family, within the construct of a respectful society. I pray that we continue to learn this from the trauma we are still surviving, and that we can be kind and considerate all the time. To play us in on this beautiful morning, here's the Israeli singer Gidi Gov singing Kanireh Shelo Amar.
אני לא יודע איך לומר לך כנראה שלא איך כל פעם שאני איתך אז הלב שלי נשבע מאוהב בחד מעל הראש כמו ילדון קטן רק תבטיחי לי שאם אומר את לא תצחקי אני לא יודע איך לומר לך כנראה שאי אפשר להסביר סתם במילים פשוטות ולכן אני לחשב
That was Gidi Gov's lovely song, Kanireh Shelo Amar. When we return in a few moments on Two Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Natasha Mozgovaya, the chief U.S. correspondent for the leading Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz, a terrific young observer of the Israeli scene, learn what the issues are for Israel today, and especially how it's handling immigration now in a country founded by immigrants when we come back on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. When we were kids, my mom used to tell Vinny and me, take time and smell the meatballs. Back then, Vinny and I always took this literally. After all, the smell of meatballs was often present in our home. But as time has gone by, we've learned there's more to Mom's reminder. Now we know that when you stop and smell the meatballs, you're really taking time to do stuff with attention, love, and care. In restaurant terms, it means we need to select the right ingredients for our pizzas, sandwiches, and salads. We need to simmer our sauces for just the right amount of time. We need to hand assemble our calzones and lovingly season and bake our garlic cheese toast. Yes, at Mama's, to stop and smell the meatballs means lots of things, including taking time to sometimes actually stop and smell the meatballs. Because trust me, they do smell good. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
We're delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Natasha Mozgovaya. She is the chief U.S. correspondent for the Israeli paper Haaretz. She has been so since 2008. Born in the Soviet Union in 1979 into a family of Russian Jewish journalists, immigrated to Israel in 1990 and part of the great wave of immigration. She became a leading journalist in Israel, reporting from all around the world, in-depth articles on a variety of topics. She has anchored several television programs, including the Investigative Report program's Special Department on Channel 9, Hosim Ruach, a cultural program on Channel 1, and many others. Good morning, Natasha.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Tell us a little bit about your sort of first impressions. Israel is such a fascinating and diverse melting pot, and one of the issues that American Jews, I think, are most interested in is, you know, we have certain perceptions of what Israel is, but Israel's changing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, let's start with the assumption that there is a melting pot, because nowadays you don't have anymore this figure of tzabar that you're supposed to emulate. You don't have those girls, you know, with the long hair and dancing and singing Zionist songs. So
everybody isn't dancing the hora, you know.
No, let's start with the small details, like for example, 30 years ago, which maybe could be almost incomprehensible when you're making Aliyah, not to change your name, or at least, you know, not to experience some kind of pressure to do so. Nowadays, almost no one is doing it, and even Ethiopians, which are considered to be the least empowered group in Israel, even they are not changing usually their names, and sometimes they're actually going back to the traditional Ethiopians' names, which could be an indicator of where is this magnet that we all are supposed to be attracted to.
Right, the Zionist spirit that's going to make everybody a new Jew.
Define as Zionism today. I mean, I guess settlers would tell you one thing, and I guess the Israel equivalents of Jewish Voices for Peace will tell something totally opposite.
You know, it's fascinating because I think that in America, we think about America as a melting pot, and Canadians, another immigrant society, call themselves a mosaic. Maybe Israel's becoming more of that kind of an idea. Lots of mosaics in the history of Israel, so.
Yeah, but in order to sustain a successful mosaic, you need to keep a certain level of curiosity towards the culture of each other. And Israel, because of the constant threat, because of this siege mentality and other reasons, maybe people are not curious enough to discover the culture of the newcomers. Maybe, you know, maybe Jews from 120 countries, it's too much, you know, to absorb and too much to discover. But anyway, for example, I can give you a small example from the community that I'm coming from. The Russian food could be pretty good, but you won't find in Israel Russian restaurants oriented to Israelis. You do have Moroccan cuisine, you do have Iraq cuisine, but almost no Israeli will go, you know, to demand borscht and pirozhki in some kind of Russian restaurant. You have plenty of them, but it's kind of cultural ghetto.
Culinary ghetto. I like that. Well, I don't know if I like it, but it's an excellent description. We will talk much more with Natasha Mozgovaya when we return on Two Jewish about what Israel is all about today.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance. And I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org. You are what you eat. So what does that mean for your morality? Do the choices you make about food affect your ethics? And can food standards unite Jews and Muslims as nothing else does? These and other questions will be answered by Dr. Joseph Regenstein, the outstanding authority on religious requirements for food, who will explore the ethics of eating at the premier Jewish educational event in Southern Arizona, the 2011 Bill Gray Lectureships of Temple Emmanuel. On Thursday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. at Hillel at the University of Arizona, Professor Regenstein will speak on everything you always wanted to know about kosher and halal but were afraid to ask. Then, on Friday, February 4th at 7:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, he'll tell the whimsical story of how the Oreo cookie became kosher. And then, Saturday, February 5th at noon at the Rabbi's Tisch during a kosher and moral lunch, he'll explore the ethical treatment of food workers and animals. All the events are free and open to the public, except for the Friday night dinner, which has a charge. Call 327-4501 for more information about the ethics of eating at Temple Emmanuel. That's 327-4501.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. I've been reading a fine biography of George Washington, written by Ron Chernow. One of the fascinating elements of Washington's personality that emerges is that he, unlike many of the founding fathers, was actually quite religiously pious, and he worshipped regularly in various churches throughout his peripatetic military career. But it was his abiding conviction that no faith, not even his own, should ever come to dominate the American political system or enforce its will or beliefs on anyone. He had chaplains appointed to every one of his regiments, but insisted that they be from diverse denominational backgrounds, and that the religious preferences of his men always were protected and respected. And Washington himself would rotate his personal attendance to various religious services, regardless of where he really wanted to go, so that no one could claim they represented the official religious commitment of the commander-in-chief. It was conduct like this that highlighted what became the clear line in American public life between religion and state. It is one of the most valuable and important aspects of American identity. It is one of the things that makes America great. Unfortunately, some people just don't understand this church-state distinction. And sadly, most of those who don't are pious, evangelical, elected Christians. Last week, the newly elected Alabama governor, Robert Bentley, told a church crowd just moments into his new administration that those who have not accepted Jesus as their Savior are not his brothers and sisters. This shocked a few critics who questioned whether he can possibly be fair to non-Christians as governor. Speaking at Dexter Avenue King Memorial Church after the official inaugural ceremony, Governor Bentley told the crowd that he considered anyone who believed in Jesus to be his brothers and sisters regardless of color. But anyone who isn't a Christian doesn't have that same relationship to him. If the Holy Spirit lives in you, that makes you my brothers and sisters, he said. Anyone who has not accepted Jesus, I want to be your brothers and sisters too. Well, Governor Bentley, frankly, I don't want to be your brother. That's the price, certainly. After his speech, Bentley said he didn't mean to insult anyone. Ah, but he succeeded. Responding to questions, Bentley's office released a statement saying he believes he is the governor of all of Alabama. The governor clearly stated that he will be the governor of all Alabamians, Democrat, Republican, and Independent, young, old, black and white, rich and poor. As stated in his address, Governor Bentley believes his job is to make everyone's lives better. As long as they are Christians, apparently. Ashfaq Taufik, president of the Birmingham Islamic Society, said he wasn't sure how Bentley's remarks were intended. Does it mean that those who, according to him, are not saved are less important than those who are saved? Does he want those of us who do not belong to the Christian faith to adopt his faith? Taufik asked. That's not what we need. If he means that, I hope he changes it. We don't want evangelical politicians. They can be whatever in their private life. Nygut, the official with the ADL, which fights discrimination against Jews and others, said it sounded like Bentley was using the office of governor to advocate for Christian conversion. If he does so, he's dancing dangerously close to a violation of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which forbids government from promoting the establishment of any religion, Nygut said. Well, there is undoubtedly an element on the American airwaves these days that doesn't quite understand how central this separation is to our identity. Frankly, it is one of the most important influences in keeping religion so much more popular in the United States than in other Western industrialized countries. What you believe in private is absolutely protected by our Constitution and Bill of Rights. But religious ideas that you advocate as a public official are not so protected and should never be. I hope the new governor of Alabama learns this, and soon. We're delighted to welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, the head of the Israel Center here. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you today?
I'm well, and a belated Chag Sameach for Tu Bishvat, the Jewish New Year for trees. It took place last Thursday.
Chag Sameach. Yeah, Tu Bishvat is certainly one of my favorite holidays. You get to eat a lot of, grapefruits and...
Figs and grapes and any kind of fruits, nuts.
Right, and... My strongest memory of Tu Bishvat is from days when I was a kid in school in Israel. The tradition was to go and plant trees on Tu Bishvat. That was the main tradition. Every Tu Bishvat, we would go, all the classroom, all the kids, go on a bus, drive somewhere, and plant trees. And it's amazing because when you look in Israel, Israel is actually the only Western country that had more trees at the end of the century than it had at the beginning of the century. And maybe part of it is due to this tradition of Tu Bishvat.
It was your trees that made, that pushed them over the top, that made the difference. One of the great Zionist miracles that we talked about for so long, people don't talk about it as much anymore, but it still is amazing, was the reforestation of Israel, recovery of swampland, draining the swamps, planting, and then foresting hillsides that had not had forests since they were cut down to make railroad ties under the Turks. Are people still planting forests in Israel, or are they busy doing other things for the nature?
Well, people are still planting forests. There is some kind of an argument whether or not we should continue planting or give nature time to take its course. Also, there's some debate regarding what type of trees should be planted, because originally they planted pine trees.
Pine trees, right.
And the type of pine trees they used was a pine that usually dies after 50 years. So now we see many of those forests starting to die. And
of course, some, they were all planted at about the same time, so they all die at once.
Exactly. Some of the specialists claim that we should, if we plant, we should look for trees that were originally natural to this area, like olive trees, or like there are many wide leaf trees that are relevant to the Mediterranean and to the Middle East, and they claim we should use those because they will survive better and will be able to reproduce in the climate of Israel.
So the next stage in Israel's consciousness of nature. There's an organization called the Chevre Haganat HaTeva, which is probably worth mentioning briefly here. Can you explain what it is?
Yeah, HaChevre Haganat HaTeva, or in translation to English, the Company for Protecting the Nature, is a leading organization in protecting the environment and the nature in Israel. One of the amazing projects that they do is a project called the Chaibar in Haifa and also at the southern part of Israel, at Yotveta, which is aimed in bringing animals back into the nature. They take animals that have disappeared from the landscape of Israel and bringing them back and helping them go back into the nature, the natural habitat. Another aspect is, of course, protecting natural resorts all across Israel, and they're doing amazing job. They also lead educational programs for kids, children, teenagers, and they're amazing. They're really amazing.
Thank you, Guy. A great subject for Tu B'Shvat last week, and really always. Thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife. Although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour, late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently went to South America, which has an extraordinary Jewish history and kind of a complicated Jewish present. Let's set the background there.
Yeah, well, I was, for peculiar personal reasons, in Argentina and Chile, neither of which has the oldest Jewish community in South America. Although I think Argentina arguably has the largest Jewish community in South America, in spite of recent economic troubles and a lot of Jews emigrating from there. I think it's still pretty large and pretty serious and well dispersed throughout the country, not limited to the capital city of Buenos Aires. As you pointed out to me just before we went on the air, some of the oldest Jewish communities in the New World are in South America, like Recife in Brazil, which was strange because Brazil was a Portuguese colony. Portugal expelled its Jews right after Spain did, a few years later.
1498.
Right. And Portugal participated as enthusiastically in the Inquisition as Spain did. And yet, in its colonies and in the development of those colonies, it seemed to be more welcoming of Jews than Spain was. Now, eventually...
Slightly, I might add, because, of course, they left Recife, a lot of them, and went and founded this New Amsterdam place when the Dutch were kicked out by the Portuguese in one of their internecine struggles.
Right.
Which became an important Jewish community somewhere, I forget.
Right.
New York, I think.
Home of bagels.
Yes.
So eventually, of course, Argentina, Chile, and all the rest of South America, with a few minor exceptions, became independent from their colonial masters and got rid of the Inquisition and have sought and are in some cases still seeking to minimize the influence of the Catholic Church. But they became more welcoming of Jews, and particularly in the years after World War II, many, many Jews sought refuge in South American countries and found relatively warm welcomes and a relatively tolerant atmosphere with a certain degree of traditional Catholic ambivalence about the Jews as Christ killers, the Jews, as baby killers who use Christian babies' blood to make Passover matzah, right, et cetera, et cetera.
All these
old superstitions, which have mostly been overcome in Catholic countries in Europe, tend to persist a bit longer, particularly in smaller places, in rural communities, mountain regions in South America. Nonetheless, in the big cities of Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Venezuela, et cetera, there are thriving Jewish communities. And I saw evidence of one during my recent trip, which raised some other questions, which we probably don't have time to discuss this week, but I would like to tell you a little anecdote that raised a lot of questions for me when we have a chance to speak next week.
That sounds great, Tom. Thank you, and we'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. The rabbi is in the hospital room of a critically ill congregant. The man, Moshe, has been an important member of the shul for decades. The rabbi is very close to him. Suddenly, Moshe, who is intubated and unable to speak, motions for the rabbi to come over frantically. Thinking he's about to hear the man's last request, the rabbi comes close. But with a tube in his mouth, Moshe can't speak. The rabbi grabs a pad of paper and pencil, hands it to him, and the dying man scribbles furiously. But just as he finishes the note and hands it to the rabbi, the alarms go off. He collapses, the monitors show no heart rate, and Moshe dies. In all the hubbub, the rabbi jams the note in his coat pocket and forgets it's there. At the funeral, the rabbi is eulogizing Moshe beautifully. He brushes against the podium and realizes he still has the note in his pocket. Thinking quickly, he decides to read the note out loud. "It so happens," says the rabbi in a stentorian voice, "I have here the last words of this righteous man on this paper, and I will read them now." And he reads, "Rabbi, you're standing on my air hose." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as nearly any other section of the whole Torah. After the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic portions featuring highlights from the entirety of Jewish tradition, indeed of all religious history, Mishpatim comes as a kind of major letdown. Last week, amid smoke and thunder on Mount Sinai, we got the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea and we miraculously crossed on dry land. And the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians and Pharaoh and Moses had their duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. How exciting. How to handle somebody else's property fairly. How to assess punitive damages for a man who injures another or destroys property. How to act when somebody puts his or her property in trust with you. Laws of manslaughter and theft and damages, torts. The Torah is truly our fundamental moral text. This is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems trivial. So trivial as maybe not to belong in the Torah at all. So why is it here? In truth, human beings have no love of law or lawyers. But without laws and without enforcement, we fallible creatures wouldn't function very well at all. The Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. Where anarchy reigns, justice doesn't. And that's where Mishpatim comes in. For we need law and limits, although we might not like either one very much. Judaism understands that if we are to be truly good or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Because before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Poet Adrian Rich put it well. These atoms filmed by ordinary dust that common life, freedom. It isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose-bound, routine remembering, putting together inch by inch the starry worlds. freedom and holiness are dependent on the little laws established in Mishpatim. We can achieve both when we learn and follow the best of them. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll meet with the beautiful and brilliant Natasha Mozgovaya, chief U.S. correspondent for Haaretz, the leading Israeli daily, and find out how immigrants in Israel are treated today and what could be done about it when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The PLO office in Washington raised its flag for the first time. It's about time this flag that symbolizes the struggle of the Palestinian people for self-determination and statehood is raised in the United States, said PLO envoy Mayan Arikat in a brief ceremony last week outside the DuPont Circle offices of the Palestinians. We hope that this will help in the international effort to provide recognition for the Palestinian state. The Obama administration granted the delegation, which does not have embassy status, permission to raise the flag back in July. Palestinian Authority officials last year launched an effort to broaden international recognition of a state of Palestine within the 67 borders of the West Bank and Gaza. The officials targeted Europe and Latin America, two areas of the world where nations resisted the last such push back in the 1980s. Seven South American nations have now signed on to the effort. Senior Israeli officials say they fear European governments will join them. Last week, Russia's government reaffirmed its 1988 recognition, which was accorded Palestine by its Soviet predecessors. Arikat has said that such recognition is not statehood, but ratchets up pressure on Israel to freeze settlement building. Palestinian Authority has abandoned direct talks. They did so in September because Israel's government refused to extend its partial building freeze. And U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman will not run for re-election in the year 2012. Lieberman, the independent from Connecticut, who became the first Jewish nominee on a major presidential ticket when Al Gore took him as his running mate in 2000, announced his decision in Hartford. Lieberman lost favor with Democrats over his support for the Iraq War, and he lost the Connecticut Democratic primary in 2006, but then ran as an independent and won. He has caucused with the Democrats, but backed Senator John McCain for president in 2008. In Israel, Defense Minister and former Labor Prime Minister and Too Jewish guest Ehud Barak decided last week to quit Labor, which he had headed until, Monday. This sent shockwaves throughout the Israeli political establishment. Ironically, the split up of Labor, until this week a part of the Israeli government, but now officially in the opposition, may yet strengthen the coalition of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, no Laborite. Barak's decision to quit Labor and found a new political party along with four other Labor defectors leaves Netanyahu with eight fewer members in his coalition, but the 66 who remain are considered far more stable than the 74 he had before the defection. Before Barak's dramatic announcement, Labor was threatening to withdraw all 13 of its Knesset members unless Netanyahu could show progress in peacemaking with the Palestinians. That would have left the prime minister with only 61 coalition members, the vast majority right-wingers, and the very minimum necessary to remain prime minister in the 120-seat Knesset. Such a narrow coalition would have opened up Netanyahu to harsh domestic and international criticism for leading a hardline government. Now, in what appears to have been a carefully coordinated move, Netanyahu and Barak have pulled the rug out from under the feet of their opponents. With a more stable coalition, Netanyahu almost certainly will fill out his term in office all the way through 2013. Barak preempted attempts to kick him out as labor leader and force him to leave the defense ministry by cutting a deal in which he can stay on with the defense portfolio after leaving labor. The leader of Israel's opposition, Kadima Party leader Tzipi Livni, called it the dirtiest and ugliest maneuver in Israel's political history. Well, in the dark history of Israeli politics, which are often conducted with breathtaking cynicism, that would be something. In fact, however, Livni's own party was a breakaway from Likud in 2005, when then-Prime Minister Ariel Sharon led an exodus of moderates, including Livni herself, out of Likud. In other news, Holland's first same-sex Jewish commitment ceremony was held in Amsterdam last week. The couple, not named, was united in the Synagogue of the Liberal Jewish Community. The Council of Rabbis of the Dutch Union of Progressive Judaism recently ruled that such ceremonies may be held in the country's liberal synagogues. There are nine of them. The ceremony, called a Brit Ahava, or Covenant of Love, is not an official Jewish wedding. Same-sex marriage has been legal in the Netherlands since 2001. And finally, more than 335 Falash Mura immigrants from Ethiopia arrived in Israel on a special Jewish agency charter flight. The Falash Mura, Ethiopians who claim family links to descendants of Ethiopian Jews who converted to Christianity in previous generations, arrived last week on Ethiopian Airlines charter flights. They are the first Ethiopian immigrants to arrive in Israel since back in November because of an aviation dispute between Israel and Ethiopia now settled. Israel's cabinet back in November approved a plan to bring about 8,000 more Falash Mura Ethiopians to Israel over the next 4 years. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish this morning, Natasha Mozgovaya, a very prominent Israeli journalist, born in the Soviet Union in 1979, into a family of two Russian Jewish journalists. So you followed mom and dad into the family business, didn't you?
I think I was doomed because I had other plans. I wanted to be an actress, but actually in Israel, my first years, people were saying weird things when I tried to be an actress, and I actually was filmed in some episodes and on TV, and back then, when I was still something like 17, people were saying that, you know, with your Russian accent, you will play maybe, you know, Russian prostitutes in reality shows or things like this, so maybe you should stick to writing. So eventually that's what happened, although we have now fascinating, really successful Russian Jews that came to Israel, and they just made great films. They have a great theater.
We talked a little bit already earlier in the show about the way Israeli society has changed and perhaps some of the isolation. I will tell you that back in, I don't know, I think mid-90s, I remember going and visiting a friend that I'd made in my congregation in South Carolina, and he had moved back to Israel, he was in textiles. He took me around, he says, Israel's the most racist country in the world. I said, what are you talking about? You've got people from 120, 130 countries here. He said, no, we all have our priorities. The Polish Jews are at the top. He, of course, was descended from Polish Jews. And then the German Jews think they're better, but they're not. And then the Moroccans are down here. And then the Ethiopians are here. And it was really an eye-opener because I never thought of that. And yet I also see, of course, Yemenite Jews married to Ashkenazic Jews. Lots and lots of interaction. Is that a correct reflection? Is there some of that undercurrent in Israeli society that we just don't see for Americans?
Well, there is a certain hierarchy, although it's unfortunate, but let's say it's much easier to come from the United States and to become a big consultant, you know, in some
head of the Bank of Israel, for example.
Yeah,
or something,
but
right?
But if you're coming, for example, from the former Soviet Union,
right.
Well, you can become a specialist for Russians. But for me personally, it took years to to explain to my editors that Russians can actually write about something else. And sometimes I had to be very, you know, very, let's say, straightforward, as they say in Israel, Dugri, to say, well, you are coming from Morocco, do you want to write about Moroccans all the time? It got to some unpleasant points. And I think we do still have this glass ceiling. But I think if finally, all in all, it gets better. It gets better, maybe because, as in an old satiric program, because we have sometimes the new groups that are discriminated against.
There's always a new group coming in, and the new group becomes the, I don't say the bad guys, they become the ones who come in at the bottom of the pyramid, usually. Mm-hmm. It has always impressed me that the military is the absolute socializing institution in life in Israel. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter what your parents did if you're in Sayeret Matkal or you're one of the, you know, a Golani, for example, or one of the top military units. You're going to be okay. You're going to have a chance to get
that's
it. Is that still true?
That's still true, but we have two big buts in here. First of all, the numbers of the people serving either in active duty or in reserves are diminishing.
Right.
And we have some predictions that in 10 years it will be, you know, less than 50%, maybe it will get to 40, which is of all Jewish men in Israel, which is quite
huge,
you know,
drop.
When you have a conscription army, it's a problematic issue. And secondly, you can definitely succeed in the army. The question is, if you came from if you came from Ethiopia 3 years ago, whether you will get to Sayeret Matkal, I'm not sure.
You have spent a good deal of time in India. Tell us a little bit about the newest group that's going to be coming, or that's sort of partly in Israel already, Bnei Menashe. Tell us a little bit about that experience and what that group is like.
Well, Bnei Menashe, it's a fascinating story, because these are the guys that belong to Shin, Kuki, and Mizo tribes that are... they live in northeast India on the border of Burma and Bangladesh and in China, and there they look like Chinese, basically. They don't look like Indians, and they claim that they are descendants of the 10 lost tribes, actually of one tribe of Menashe. There are about 2 million in total, but only about 7,000 of them actually returned to Judaism. And many people in Israel, especially from the secular establishment, they see them as imposters from the third world country that will, you know, convert to anything to go
just to get
to
out of India and to get to Israel.
That's
right.
True. And there are people, but when you're coming there and you're seeing those kids, you know, in the middle of nowhere, literally, see, you know, reciting mitzvot and singing Hatikva, you're just amazed. You're asking yourself, when was the last time you actually woke up for Shacharit, as they do every day. It's amazing. And actually 1,600 of them already made Aliyah to Israel. And the chief Sephardic rabbi already
said that they're
recognized
Jews,
them.
Right?
Not as Jews, descendants
of Jews, and they have
but
to do some stuff.
But it opened the door.
Right?
It opened the door. So there is still no decision of the government to bring them, you know, as a whole, because the Indian authorities are a bit skeptical, but certainly if there was a decision to bring the Falashmura, several thousands of them, to Israel.
Also about
I guess,
7,000 or 8,000 by the last count I heard.
So yeah. I guess they could be the next.
It seems to me that the relationship between Israel and India has continued to improve over the last number of years now, partly because Israel recognized how important an economic and development partner India could be. Partly because India has its own issues with Islamic countries.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. I wonder if this is also the relationship with Bnei Menashe has become a little easier issue because of the better relationship between Israel and India now.
Which relations? Between
the political relationship between Israel and India, which used to be not so good, and now seems to be improving.
No, I think right now
it's pretty
good. There are some big questions, you know, regarding the arms sales and things like that, but you know, Israel is still following the U.S. lead, so there are no big questions that are real dilemmas that you cannot solve, you know, when facing certain kind of pressure from the U.S.
What would be your dream story to write about for Haaretz right now?
I have such a long list of dream stories that, you know, it's almost impossible to say. But, for example, coming to Arizona was definitely on my list, at least in the U.S., because there are lots of similarities between what's going on here, for example, on the border and what we are experiencing right now in Israel with our southern border, because we have, let's say, the defense wall,
the border fence.
It is more a security issue, but when you have refugees coming from Sudan, Eritrea, it's a humanitarian issue. But for Israel, even those numbers of dozens per day, it's a lot because it's a small country. So we really have to the same dilemma as I guess Arizona do: how to treat them, how not to lose your humanity, but how not to lose your identity as well. So it's I was just curious to see how
do we do it?
Yeah.
Not too well, I would say, but the numbers here, of course, are huge. But Israel's been dealing with a couple of questions in terms of the workers who were brought in the midst of the Intifada, mm-hmm. and then wanted to stay.
The Israeli Bracero program, I guess.
Right, okay. Israeli Bracero program, exactly. Many of them from places like Thailand, the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that is now in terms of the immigration issue that it's raised? Because Israel has been there now is a significant sort of undocumented worker program, mm-hmm. in Israel.
Yeah, we have about 120,000 of the undocumented workers, and several governments tried to deal with it differently. We had a very aggressive policy of actually hunting them down, and those raids in the center of Tel Aviv,
right.
that became a haven for many of them. It didn't really work because Israel economy, you know, as much as American economy, I guess, needs cheap
workers.
Labor.
Right.
Right, and they don't want to bring the Palestinians and the Russians that they thought that, you know, maybe 20 years ago that might replace the Palestinian workers. Okay, 10 years passed, and the Russians are one-third of the Israeli high-tech, so it didn't really work. And
it worked great, it just didn't work to replace the bottom level of society.
So there is a vacuum, and you do need to fill it, and of course there are all sorts of agencies that are taking advantage of it. It's a big problem for a small country, but I think that there are some stories that are just, you know, fascinating of children of the foreign workers that have academic achievements if they are allowed, you know, to study in normal schools and are not, you know, hunted. There are guys who are actually going to serve in the Israeli military. So once again, as we were talking about in the beginning about the melting pot and those questions of who is a Jew, who is an Israeli. I think each story like this just adds, you know, a big question mark to this question.
To figuring out the identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great discussion. Just to give you a sense of proportion, 100,000 undocumented workers in Israel. Israel has about 7+ million people. America has about 350 million people. So if you multiply it by 50, you get some idea. There would be about 5 million undocumented workers in the United States by proportion. So it gives you some idea. It's a significant problem, even for a small country.
Yeah, sometimes it's good to go back to proportion.
Started to think, a little smaller, please. I want to thank Natasha Moskovaya for a great visit on Too Jewish and helping us to understand a little bit more about what Jewish identity means, what it means to be an Israeli today in this contemporary time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
You are what you eat. So what does that mean for your morality? Do the choices you make about food affect your ethics? And can food standards unite Jews and Muslims as nothing else does? These and other questions will be answered by Dr. Joseph Regenstein, the outstanding authority on religious requirements for food, who will explore the ethics of eating at the premier Jewish educational event in Southern Arizona, the 2011 Bill Gray Lectureships of Temple Emmanuel. On Thursday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. at Hillel at the University of Arizona, Professor Regenstein will speak on everything you always wanted to know about kosher and halal but were afraid to ask. Then, on Friday, February 4th at 7:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, he'll tell the whimsical story of how the Oreo cookie became kosher. And then, Saturday, February 5th at noon at the Rabbi's Tisch during a kosher and moral lunch, he'll explore the ethical treatment of food workers and animals. All the events are free and open to the public, except for the Friday night dinner, which has a charge. Call 327-4501 for more information about the ethics of eating at Temple Emmanuel. That's 327-4501.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Dr. Joseph Regenstein, the 2011 Rabbi Albert T. Bilgrey Scholar at Temple Emmanuel, an expert on food and food sciences and the religious laws and regulations of both Kashrut and Muslim Halal, here to talk about the ethics of eating, a subject very close to Jewish hearts and stomachs. Our playout this morning also comes from Israeli singer and entertainer and talk show host and food critic Gidi Gov from his last studio album, Biktzeh Ha'har, At the End of the Mountain. It's an appropriate tune for the day after we read the Torah portion of Yitro about the great revelation on Mount Sinai, another kind of mountaintop. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
צועק מקצה ההר, צועק חזק אל השמיים, עד אשר אולי תמצא.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.